Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Rich Cohen, whose new book is The Last Pirate of New York, A Ghost Ship, A Killer, and the Birth of a Gangster Nation. We'll also hear from Nick Courage, whose new young adult novel is Stormblown. Cohen is the author of such New York Times bestsellers as Tough Jews, Monsters, Sweet and Low, The Sun and the Moon and the Rolling Stones, and The Chicago Cubs, Story of a Curse. He's also the author of that New Orleans classic, The Fish That Ate the Whale, The Life and Times of America's Banana King, a biography of Samson Murray. Rich Cohen's books may range far and wide from music to sports and Jewish history, but almost everyone has some nod to New Orleans, which was his home when he attended Tulane University. Today, we're talking about his new book, The Last Pirate of New York, A Ghost Ship, A Killer, and the Birth of a Gangster Nation. Rich, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Very happy to be here.
So the story of Albert Hicks is another wild tale of yours, tracing a story back to 1869 and uncovering the life of the man you call the closest thing we have to a first gangster.
Yeah, to me, Albert Hicks is sort of like the era of New York City when you had pirates actually anchored off 14th Street. He's sort of, when you go back to the beginning of the underworld in America, you come to him. To me, I always say he's like Bluebeard turns into John Gotti. And he sort of sets the model, not only in his crimes and the way he lived, but even the way he dressed for so much of that you even see like in a movie like The Godfather, you're seeing some distant copy of Albert Hicks.
So what is this fascination of yours with gangsters? You grew up hearing these stories from your dad, right?
Yeah, well, I grew up in a very sort of bland place outside of Chicago, and my friends were kids named Dennis, Todd, Jamie. My father grew up in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, and his friends were named Hoo-Ha, Inky, Gutter Rat, and Sheppo. And his stories were just way more interesting than mine, and some of them were about gangsters who grew up in the neighborhood where he lived. And when I first got to New York, I wanted to find out how true his stories were. The result of that was Tough Jews. And then when I really got into the history of the underworld in New York and go back and say, well, who came before that guy? Who came before that guy? And who came before that guy? You get all the way back to sort of the Paul Bunyan days of the underworld. And that was so long ago that they weren't gangsters. They were pirates. One of the first books that really influenced me, well, I read Treasure Island when I was a kid, and I read a biography in class about John Lafitte. And John Lafitte's a famous pirate, but when you read about the way he operated, he was really just a gangster. I mean, He was selling things that you couldn't buy, you know, so he was a black marketeer. He was a gangster. Just the mode of transportation changed over time.
Wow. So tell us about this horrendous crime of Albert Hicks. And it was really horrendous.
Well, the thing that kept drawing me back to it was how it began. Over 20 years, I've tried to approach the story again and again, always fixated on how it began, which was New York, like New Orleans, big port, everything dependent on the water. And one day, everybody woke up and looked out to sea, and there in New York Harbor was what they called a ghost ship. It was like the most terrifying thing you could see. And it was this oyster sloop just drifting around New York Harbor, and the police went out, and it was completely empty. And it was this big mystery, and they examined it. They said there were no people on board, but it looked like the decks had been washed in blood. And they towed it ashore to South Street, which is still just like it was then. And the detectives, and this was a new story of detectives, because this was before any kind of DNA, even before plastic baggies. I mean, no fingerprints. They just had to figure it out, like they were reading a book. And they searched the whole ship. Then somebody noticed something under the rail, and it was four severed fingers and a thumb. And that's all they found of the ship, and they had to use that to sort of try to track down this whole story. And I was just fixated on that as a mystery, like sort of a two-hander of one, the gangster and the gangster world, and two, how the detectives went on this manhunt that completely riveted New York City the summer before the Civil War.
And the manhunt is like such a chase in this book. I mean, the way you reconstruct every step.
Well, he really acted like a pirate. And a lot of people look at that and sort of say, why was he so incautious? Why did he make such a spectacle of himself? Because back then, for a crime like murder, basically, if you weren't caught in the act or you weren't witnessed doing it, if you got away, there was no way to connect you to that crime. And as soon as he got off the ship and got in the dinghy and got to Staten Island, he had all this money and he just made a spectacle of himself. There's articles in the New York Times from then, this was in 1860, of him basically waiting for the Staten Island ferry, making everybody drink with him and sing with him and eating oysters and eggs and making a spectacle of himself. So he left witnesses everywhere and he believed that there was no bodies. He could never be convicted of a crime. He made a mistake with those fingers and a thumb. He thought he'd sunk the ship, and he had a very, very dedicated detective on his trail who he couldn't shake. And finally, the story was, no bodies, no murder. They tried him for piracy, and in piracy, you didn't need a body. And as a result of that, he ultimately became the last person publicly executed in New York City. And it's incredible how fast it goes, because the ship they find in the harbor in March, and he's executed on Friday, July 13th. And it's just this wild story that just rivets everybody through the summer. And some people think he's the one who popularized the phrase, dead men tell no tales. Ultimately, he confessed to all these crimes, but he always basically killed any witnesses, so there was no one ever to testify against him.
The newspapers whipped up such a frenzy of interest in this, didn't they? It's a really interesting story of newspapers as well.
You know, at that time, not only in New York, but in every big city in the country, there were dozens and dozens of newspapers and close to 50 in New York that had afternoon, morning, and evening editions. And if you really wanted to catch an audience, they had these penny for a newspaper, you went with crime. And this is really one of the stories that established the New York Times and turned it into what it is. Because the New York Times is only 10 years old, and they got on this story early, and the story was a sensation. And one of their reporters was actually able to embed himself, and they actually used that term, with the detectives, and was writing reports all along the way. And it was this newspaper guy named Elias Smith who ultimately broke the case open and was the first guy to confront the killer.
I know. I really thought that was fascinating, the way he was right there with them all the time. It's amazing to see how Albert Hicks becomes really the first celebrity criminal, because when he's imprisoned in the Tombs, he's entertaining this line of visitors, this endless chain of people, and then the crowd that turned out for the public execution.
First, he'd used a fake name. He sailed under a fake name. So at first, it was just a big real-life mystery for people figuring out who'd done this horrible thing. And people were scared knowing this person was on the loose. And when they finally caught him, found out his real name, and brought him back to New York, he'd been hiding out in Rhode Island. There were thousands of people waiting at every railroad stop that he had to make, finally in the city and then at the jail in New York. And people were surprised because he was really handsome. And they thought that he should look like a monster, and he didn't. He looked like a, well, there weren't movie stars, but he looked like a stage star, let's say. And he was a great dresser. I was part of his whole thing. So he became this kind of first real celebrity criminal in New York, and people went down to the Tombs prison in New York to visit him. And one of those people was P.T. Barnum, who knew a good show when he saw it. P.T. Barnum basically said, I'll give you $25 cash, which he could leave, the killer could leave to his wife and his newborn child, and two boxes of 5-cent cigars, which were nice cigars at the time, to make a mask of your face. And that was on display. They made a wax figure of him, which was on display in P.T. Barnum's first big museum called the American Museum on Broadway in New York for 10 years. And that did a lot to make him a very famous person after his death, because he was on display in this museum that millions of people went to as the worst man who ever lived, which is what he called himself.
Yes. And before that, New Orleans had been an important stop on his ascent in the crime world. So tell us a little bit about his time here.
Yeah, when he was very young, he gave this wild, very strange confession before he died, which is where a lot of the information comes from. And it's sort of this surreal document, and his life is unbelievable. But he was raised on a farm in Connecticut. He committed a petty crime when he was young. He ended up in an adult prison where he was brutalized. And in that prison, he said, if I ever get out of here, I'm going to take my revenge on the world. And he did that for the next 20 years till they caught him. And ultimately, he settled into a pattern where he lived in New Orleans, and he had a partner named Tom Stone, and they had this routine where they would go from New Orleans to Liverpool, England. And they would go from Liverpool, England to Brazil, and then from Brazil back to New Orleans in this kind of triangle for about 5 years, where they would just rob people and mutiny on ships all along the way. So New Orleans became one of the places he laid low, and one of the places he sort of loved. He was in a shipwreck in the Gulf of Mexico, off of Alabama, actually, and he was the only person to survive that shipwreck, and he was picked up by basically what would become like a U.S. Coast Guard boat, and that was really the beginning of his end, because without his partner, he got into all this kind of mischief because his partner had died in that shipwreck.
Wow.
So you really get a picture of him. He went to the best places, you know. He was in New York. He was in New Orleans. He was in Hawaii because he was on whaling ship. But it's interesting, in his confession, he doesn't call it Hawaii. He calls it the Sandwich Island, which is what it was still called.
Mm-hmm.
And he keeps describing a city called Yahoo. And I finally figured out it's Oahu.
Oahu, of course.
Talking about. And it was also in French Tahiti, which he calls Taipei Bay. Of course he was in New Orleans, because that's where all the money was flowing through, and he was trading on the money, and there was this huge trade between New Orleans and New York. And it's interesting, because a lot of this is like what New York was like right before the Civil War. And I think 10% of the people living in New York were Southerners. And New York was so dependent on the cotton coming from the South that there was a mayor of New York, Fernando Wood, didn't want to join the Union, didn't want to join the Confederacy either. He wanted to make New York an independent city-state that would stay neutral in the war. And that was the period where Albert Hicks was operating, which is one of the reasons I think it became such a big story, was because something about the evilness of him and the evilness of his crimes captured the mood of the city in a hysterical moment, a moment of real fear and terror just before the Civil War. And there's a wild thing, a newspaper column I came across, where a porter goes in and interviews him in his prison cell, and he keeps saying, the five people on the ship, the five people on the ship. And the reporter says, stop lying to me. There was four people on the ship. And he says, no, the fifth person was the devil. And this wasn't like, he wasn't speaking of the devil in symbolic terms.
Right.
He believed in the devil as a real presence that he'd made a deal with in that prison back in Connecticut, and that the devil had broken that deal when he was caught.
Wow. Now, this is another one of, you know, it's a violent story. It's a thrilling story. But also at rock bottom, like so many of your books, it's another love story about New York during one of its most fascinating periods. I mean, I felt like you were walking the trail with the policeman and the reporter. I mean, it had such energy and urgency, and New York has been a great muse for you.
I always said I grew up in exile because my father was from Brooklyn. And when people used to ask me what his job was, I'd say I thought his full-time job is being from Brooklyn. And every time I did anything, like if I was about to eat a corned beef sandwich in Chicago, just before I took my first bite, he'd say, that's a much better sandwich in New York. Or if I'd go see a play, he'd say, just before it started, this is a touring company. The real play is in New York. So I always had the sense as New York is like the place. It was kind of a condition and a disease he instilled in me. After I left Tulane, I went right to New York, and I got a job as a messenger at the New Yorker magazine, just by complete fluke. And I started just wandering around the city, and I completely became obsessed with the city. And then I discovered these old New Yorker writers that had written about the city that completely changed my mind around about what I want to do with my life, you know.
Uh-huh.
At that point, I was planning like to get a master's or a PhD in history or become a lawyer. I didn't know what I was going to do, but I read Joseph Mitchell.
Yes.
And I read A.J. Liebling.
Mm-hmm.
And I read Meyerberger, and Joseph Mitchell was alive, and he sort of mentored me a little bit. And it completely kind of turned my mind around, and I became obsessed by the city as it was and the little places where you can still see remnants of the city as it had been, kind of the ancient city. That's what I found in Albert Hicks, which is I found very early version of the New York that I still knew and that was still around and was at the heart of the thing. And I was obsessed by the idea that there was an underworld history that was just as vibrant and just as real as the sort of official history of New York. And so, yeah, to me, it is like a love story to New York.
Well, and it's also such a thrill ride. But I have to say, I'm glad New Orleans still has her hooks in you just a little bit. We've been talking with Rich Cohen, whose fascinating new book is The Last Pirate of New York, A Ghost Ship, A Killer, and the Birth of a Gangster Nation. Rich, thank you so much.
Always a great pleasure to talk.
Courage has one of the best names for a young adult writer I've ever heard, and his characters face difficult situations with unfailing courage every time. Nick grew up in New Orleans, but left before his senior year in high school and has lived all over the world. Now he lives in Pittsburgh with his wife and his two cats. His first book was The Loudness. Today we're talking about his new novel, Stormblown. Nick Courage, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, Stormblown chronicles the relentless advance of a megastorm called Hurricane Valerie and its effect on your characters. So first, tell us about Alejo, who is a young boy who lives in San Juan.
So Alejo is basically a young kid during the summer who's working with his padrino at a beachfront resort, and he's sort of left to his own devices, which becomes problematic as this hurricane sort of launches a surprise attack on San Juan.
And then there's Emily, who is a young New Orleans girl, and her brother Elliot.
Right. So Emily and Elliot have a lot of me in them, in that they are kids who live within walking distance of Audubon Park. They're sort of free-range kids. Emily is more free-range than her brother Elliot, who has been battling some illnesses. So she's dead set on having some adventures for the both of them.
And Emily collects animals, which I love. She collects a goose and a turtle. And you remind us that all of these animals are also in the storm's path, and that island in Audubon Park is a really important part of the setting in this novel. So what are your memories of Audubon Park?
I spent a lot of time as a kid with the ducks and the geese at Ochsner Island or Bird Island, just right there in Audubon Park. When I was growing up, some of my favorite books were about kids empowering themselves to set off into the wilderness. So My Side of the Mountain, that's my favorite, by Jean Craighead George, Island of Blue Dolphins, Girl of the Sea of Cortez by Peter Benchley, who wrote Jaws, Hatchet. So I'd be reading those books, and then I'd go see the ducks and the rookery at Audubon Park, and I just always had this daydream about wading through the lagoon and setting up camp on that island like Sam Gribble in My Side of the Mountain. So this book sort of started off very much in that vein of a survivalist kid on Ochsner Island, and then it sort of grew from there.
That's Emily's favorite book as well, My Side of the Mountain.
Yes. In earlier drafts, it really featured maybe too heavily, so I found the My Side of the Mountain, but that is one of my favorite books in the world. I started off wanting to write that kind of classic children's literature, and then I sort of quickly realized that we live in such a different world than when those classic survivalist stories were written, and that if I was writing a book set in New Orleans during hurricane season, summer months, it would seem so incredibly fantastic for that book not to factor a hurricane. You know, like if you look at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration data from 1980 on, so when those survivalist books were written, it's just such a different world now when it comes to hurricanes and wilderness survival. So the working title of the book was Feather Island, because it really was about that little island in Audubon Park. And then I realized that, you know, I wanted to write a story where a kid is empowered to set out into the wilderness, one of those classic children's literature survivalist stories. But I needed to acknowledge a world where nature is a little less cooperative than it may have been in the past, and where self-reliance only gets you so far. And also a story that sort of acknowledges the more global system of a hurricane and the interconnectedness of people and animals in a storm.
Well, that's what you do so wonderfully in these chapters that are devoted to a young petrel who's trapped inside the hurricane itself. I wonder if you'd explain that phenomenon of the birdcage, because those are really interesting, lovely, scary chapters.
Yes, very scary and very fun to write. I wish I could write an entire book just about those storm birds, which is what they're called. They're birds that get stuck inside the cyclone of a hurricane. So after a hurricane, you might see tropical birds on distant shores that you wouldn't expect. You'll see them all the time in New Orleans during hurricane season. But basically, it's like these birds are trapped in a cage and they have to keep up with the storm or sort of succumb to it.
And it's a very young bird.
It is a very young bird. I know. Well, you have to raise the stakes in these kinds of adventure books.
Right.
But I recently had a librarian in Ohio tell me that he had been reading the book on the edge of his seat. And it was only when he said that that I realized that I was actually writing the book on the edge of my seat, very stressed out for the year and a half or whatever that I was working on it. It's a long time to spend amping up the action in a hurricane.
Well, that's the thing. The storm practically becomes a character. It is so huge, so relentless, and so unstoppable. That's the whole point of the book, the nonstop action of, you know, that we can do nothing about, really, in some ways.
That's exactly right. When I realized that I needed to write about a hurricane, which I was hesitant to do because it takes a long time to write a book, and I didn't necessarily want to spend so much time as a New Orleanian with a hurricane writing a hurricane. But once I realized that I needed to write a hurricane, that was really what tied the book together, and that's really what made it sort of an action-adventure story, but also a story about empathy and interconnectedness. Once I realized that it was a big storm book, I knew I needed to follow it as it evolved through Hurricane Alley and sort of show all the potential human and animal lives it affected, with just as many connection points, just to sort of show that sort of global effect of a storm like that.
Another one of the things I enjoyed so much about this book was the author's note at the end, which I know is an odd thing to say, but it is such an informative and useful guide for young readers about their own options, things they can do. And talk about putting that together, because it's so useful for classroom, for students, for parents, everybody.
That is so great to hear. So it's important with this kind of book, this sort of action adventure thrilling book that is tied with current events, that you don't leave kids worried at the end of it. So it was really important to my editor and to my publisher that I contextualize the story about the hurricane and give readers ways to think about it that don't feel hopeless, because I think that's an easy thing to feel when you're thinking about natural disasters of this magnitude. And the natural disaster in the book, everything that happens in the book, there's sort of a scientific basis for all of it, but it is a very scary storm. So just thinking about not only tying the narrative into STEM issues, so like climate change, ways to think about climate change, but also sort of reassuring kids that there is something that they can do, that they have some agency, just like the characters in the book have agency.
I mean, you suggest so many basic actions kids can take and so many sources of education, and that's what you want them to take with them in the future.
Absolutely. Just thinking about a storm in a way that is more global, that there are other people affected, just because the news cycle, traditional disaster coverage, tends to narrowly focus on the damage that most affects us, sort of wherever we may be in any given scenario, and usually in a way that can kind of feel sensationalist before the cameras even move on. And then there's also the frustration of the 24/7 news cycle. So when the cameras do move on, it's usually before there's any real resolution. So I wanted to sort of address that in the book and also just give kids a way to think about hurricanes globally.
Mm-hmm. So do you feel like you've hit a writing groove with this book?
Oh, absolutely. This was definitely one of those projects where I got my 10,000 hours in.
All right. Well, you've got lots of excitement in there, I have to tell you. Now, I just have to bring this up. You have some great hobbies, too. I was looking at your website, and not only are you a great skateboarder, but you are also a fabulous baker.
Oh, thank you.
I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about those delicious pictures.
Oh, yeah, sure. I would love to. I'm so glad that this interview went here, because that really is a passion of mine. Started basically because I realized that I didn't know how to make any of my favorite foods or what went into it. So croissants, bagels, things that when I was living in New York, certainly I ate every morning from a cart on the street. Some of my more lavish favorite pastries, like eclairs or fruit tarts. I used to work at La Madeleine's Bakery and Cafe in New Orleans, and I would eat an eclair every day for lunch. And so I just got really into figuring out what goes into creating bagels as well, what goes into creating these kinds of baked goods, and really into the process. And it started when I was doing my edits for this book. So the edits for Stormblown were, there was a lot of fact-checking, there was a lot of work that went into these kinds of issue-driven books in general, and sort of as a break, I would bake.
How relaxing.
It was fantastic. Yeah, and I'm growing my own raspberries now, so hopefully I'll be able to make fruit tarts, my own raspberries, which is very exciting.
Well, the fruit tart pictures were the ones that really got me. Those were really very appealing.
That's definitely the thing I am. Yeah.
Now, you also, we should say, have this long background in publishing, and now you've turned to writing. So what's more fun for you? Is it the writing?
Well, publishing is great because you get to meet a lot of really fun people, and you get to work on books in sort of shorter cycles.
Right.
So working on a different book every 3 months or a different cycle of books every 3 months is really fun. But writing is really where my passion is. So that's what I still do some freelance book marketing, and I work with authors on the side, but writing is the dream.
All right. Well, keep them coming. And I know you'll be in New Orleans this fall for the book. But we'll get the word out during storm season.
Thank you so much, Susan.
Oh, my pleasure. We've been talking with Nick Courage about his new novel for young adults, The Terrific Stormblown. Nick, thank you so much.
Thank you.
There's a storm in the Gulf, and it's headed your way. You better batten down your hatches, should be all I need to say. There's a storm in the Gulf, and it's headed your way. You better batten down your hatches, should be all I need to say.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, Andrew Feldman discusses and signs Ernesto, the untold story of Hemingway in revolutionary Cuba, Tuesday, August 13th at 6 at Octavia Books. Kevin Gilhaney discusses and signs Minding the Helm, an unlikely career in the U.S. Coast Guard, Tuesday, August 13th at 6:30 at the Hubble Library in Algiers. Octavia Books presents Daniel Brook discussing The Accident of Color, a story of race and reconstruction, with archivist Greg Osborne, Wednesday, August 14th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Garden District Bookshop Book Club discusses White Houses by Amy Bloom, Wednesday, August 14th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Deb Janerson reads from and signs her book, The Women of Dauphine, Thursday, August 15th at 6 at Blue Cypress Books. The deadline for entries for the 13th Annual Ernest Jane Gaines Award for Literary Excellence is Thursday, August 15th. This prize honors outstanding fiction, novels, or short stories published in 2019. Information on criteria and entrance forms can be found at ErnestJGainesAward.com. The award, which includes a $15,000 cash prize, will be presented Thursday, January 30th, 2020, at the Manship Theater in downtown Baton Rouge. Two writers, M.A. Harper and R.J. Lee, will discuss their experiences Saturday, August 17th at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. M.A. Harper, author of The Worst Day of My Life So Far, discusses autobiographical fiction, not recommended. Fiction colored by your own backstory? Absolutely. That's at 9:30 a.m. Then, at 11, R.J. Lee, author of Grand Slam Murders. Then, at 11 a.m., R.J. Lee, author of Grand Slam Murders, presents winning tips for today's publishing market. The Octavia Books Book Club discusses The Overstory by Richard Powers, Saturday, August 17th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Former WWL anchor Lisa Shumate discusses and signs Always and Never, 20 Truths for a Happy Heart, and Always and Never, The Companion Journal, Saturday, August 17th at 2 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. And coming up, the members of the East Bank Regional Library Great Books Discussion Group have announced their reading schedule through the second half of 2019 and into the new year. They'll discuss The Reavers by William Faulkner, August 20th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The group is moderated by librarian Gwen Kelly. Don't forget to listen in next Tuesday at 7:44 a.m. during Morning Edition and 5:44 p.m. during All Things Considered for our new series, Thinking Outside the Book. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.